Hello, I'm Andrew Pearce. It's Friday, 14th of May, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, lockdown fashion, Jan Moyers, very individual take on all of that. We're talking about another poll which shows the Labour Party isn't clear on policy. I think that's why they did so badly in those elections last week. A huge, even bigger backlog now in the NHS, a record number on the waiting list. But first, Prince Harry. Now he appears to be suggesting the reason his upbringing wasn't great was because Prince Charles' upbringing wasn't great, which means, of course, he's criticising the Queen, who's still mourning Prince Philip. Prince Harry has launched yet another broadside at the royal family in which he appeared to suggest his upbringing was affected by the way his father brought him up because his father had had a pretty poor upbringing. In other words, he's criticising the Queen, who's still mourning Prince Philip. In his podcast interview in the United States, which lasted 90 minutes, he claimed he had no choice to leave the royal family so he could break the cycle of genetic pain and suffering. I'm joined now by royal biographer Penny Juner. Penny, the headline in the Mail is, how much lower can Harry sink? I don't think he could sink much lower than this, could he?
I don't think he could. I'm disgusted by him for doing this. I've written about Harry. I've met Harry many times. I've been a great fan of Harry's and admired him for the way that he, you know, has pulled through and he'd had a difficult childhood but he came good. And now, you know, he seems to be intent on a sort of narcissistic annihilation of everybody around him, everybody that has loved him. I just can't quite see what's going on with him.
It's like he's not the man
I wrote about.
No, it's like he's launched a large wrecking ball at the royal family. And we know after the Oprah Winfrey interview, which we discussed at the time, ill-advised and all that, he quickly, hastily clarified a day later, none of this criticism is intended at the Queen and Prince Philip. In other words, they weren't the ones who discussed what colour his child might or might not be, all that. But this one, it's fairly and squarely, the Queen is in his sights.
Yes. I mean, words absolutely fail me. I do not know. I mean, he seems to have entirely lost the plot. This is like some giant therapy session that he's doing publicly. And, you know, he's 37 years old. It's time he started taking some responsibility for his own life and the way he is and stop blaming other people.
Of course, it wasn't an easy life in some sense, living in the goldfish bowl, but he had a good time in the army. He lost his mother in those tragic circumstances, but he's also had a fantastically privileged life and continues to enjoy huge privilege. And he's earning millions of pounds, presumably, from making these sort of statements. He's effectively selling his royal birthright, isn't he?
Oh, that's very harsh. But, I mean, is he paid to do this podcast? I don't know. But it certainly is not going to harm his career in America, because the Americans, I think, you know, enjoy all of this stuff. And what could be greater than? I mean, it's like watching a real live top end soap opera. So they will be lapping it up.
Yeah, and apparently it's leading all the TV bulletins and radio bulletins in the United States. Prince Harry's attack on Queen Elizabeth of England.
That is just so sad. You know, the Queen has done nothing but give Harry love and comfort and inspiration. I mean, you know, when I was writing about Harry, he adored his grandmother. And every time he got into trouble, he was, you know, hugely embarrassed and sorry that he was upsetting his grandmother. His grandmother was really, really important in his life. And I thought, you know, when we saw the Oprah interview, it looked as though he was still respecting his grandmother and setting her aside from, you know, the wrecking ball, as you say, that he took to the rest of the family. But now everybody's in his sights. As I said earlier, you know, I think he has to take responsibility for who he is and how he is. He's not the only person in the world who's lost a mother. He's not the only person in the world who's had difficult circumstances in their childhoods, but they have to get over that and start living life for themselves in their way.
And if you think back, Penny, to that terrible week when he lost his mother, the Queen probably was subjected to the most criticism of her reign because she chose to stay in Balmoral with Prince Philip to protect her grandchildren, William and Harry. It would have been quite easy to have come down on Tuesday or Wednesday to meet the crowds that were growing outside Buckingham Palace. But despite the criticism, she stayed put because she thought grandmother's job was to be with those boys. Not much gratitude in the words he's used in this podcast towards his grandmother.
No. I mean, that is absolutely right. She got a lot of flack during that week after Diana died because the public thought that she was leaving her duty. But she wasn't. She was looking after those boys and she was being there for them. And you know, she has been there for them. She's the most doting, loving grandmother. And I have no doubt that, you know, she will have given him huge comfort over the years and advice over the years and stepped in a way where, you know, for the missing parent. It's a pretty rum way to treat her, as you know, after all that.
You just wonder, Penny, what comes next?
Well, I mean, I didn't think more could come after the Oprah interview.
Yeah.
And I thought that he would be quite remorseful after that. Perhaps think it was a mistake, but clearly not. And I wonder whether, you know, who's egging him on, whether this is not, you know, the Harry that we once all knew and loved.
Yeah. We haven't mentioned Meghan, of course, but you do wonder if she is the power behind the throne urging him on. We don't know.
You know, funnily enough, that was not really who I was necessarily meaning. There could be therapists in America who are saying, let it all out. You say what, you know, say it out loud. That's the way to get through all of this, you know, to deal with your past so you can move forward. I mean, you know, there's a lot of psychobabble out there, isn't there?
There is, especially in America. Penny, great to talk to you. That's the Royal Blog for Penny Juno with her views on the remarkable interview Prince Harry has given to an American podcast. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. Almost 5 million people in England now are waiting for hospital treatment as the NHS struggles to recover from the impact of COVID-19 on normal care. It's the highest number since records began. The number of people waiting for more than a year to get into hospital has risen to over 400,000. I'm joined now by Professor Pat Price. She's an oncologist and chairwoman of Action Radiotherapy and co-founder of the Catch Up with Cancer campaign. Professor Price, thanks for joining us. It's going to be very difficult to ever catch up, isn't it? These figures are so huge, it's going to be like trying to scale Mount Everest without proper climbing gear.
Absolutely right, and that's not fair on cancer patients. I think the important thing that the government and NHS senior managers need to know is that patients are desperate to get their treatment, and for every 4-week delay in treatment, there's a 10% reduction in survival. So this is absolutely time critical.
What can be done? Because there's only so much resources that the government can put into the NHS. The NHS is still dealing with COVID too. How would you recommend that hospitals, clinics start to try to get to grips with this backlog?
Well, there's been a lot of input and thoughts from a lot of frontline staff. The main thing we're saying is that it's, first of all, you have to accept there's a backlog. Over the last year, we have had a National Cancer Recovery Task Force, but they've been disbanded on the assumption that their job is done. I think
we have
to start from saying there is a massive backlog and staff cannot just work harder to catch up. And there has to be really innovative solutions. The first one is recognise there is urgency here, and have as much energy and focus as we've had on the vaccine. We need a minister in charge of this. We need government oversight. We need modelling, data analysis, see where we're doing. There is lots we can do. We can sweep away a lot of the bureaucracy, and we've got to have investment. There was nothing at the spending review. There was nothing in the budget. There was nothing in the Queen's speech. This needs money. You cannot talk your way out of this. You've got to invest your way out of this. But there's a lot we can do with a national plan. There's sharing of resources. There's shifting around the country. There's buying new machines that can treat patients, you know, three times faster or diagnose them faster. There's IT software that can save time. There's all sorts of things. And some of them are very simple solutions. So we have to do it. We've just got to have the commitment to do it and the political will and oversight. We feel like a voice in the wilderness. Frontline staff and patients know this, and yet we keep getting pushed back. It's not a big problem. This is a car crash waiting to happen. This is the most serious cancer crisis in my lifetime. We have to do something, and we can do something.
The Royal College of Surgeons says the numbers, the sort of language you don't expect from that august body, says the numbers are stomach-churning, and says ordinary people have been forced to put their lives on hold. Do you think there was any way, Professor? Understandably, the government made and the NHS made COVID the priority of the last 12, 13, 14 months, but was too much emphasis put on COVID at the expense of cancer?
Well, I think I wouldn't say too much emphasis, because obviously that was a priority, but they could have done two things at the same time. They could have accepted there was a cancer problem. We first wrote to Matt Hancock the 1st of April 2020. We have been saying this all along. As frontline staff, we can see this. And so much could have been done in that time. And so much needs to be done. It needs radical thinking. Boris has now said he wants to be a backlog buster. Well, I'd love to see that in action. But we have to have the investment. We have to have the political will to do it. It's not okay to say it'll be all right in a few years' time. These are cancer patients. Just think, we've had patients phoning us, their operations are cancelled, they're waiting, they don't know what's going on. It's awful. Bad enough having cancer, but imagine this, knowing that the top clock's ticking. It's so bad. And we feel so passionately about it. This, we will use every energy we have, and we won't stop till this is sorted. The patients are out there and they need us.
And is there any particular cancer, Professor, that is the most deeply affected, that causes you the most concern?
Well, we have the most concerns for those that are the faster growing tumours, and they've been identified, and also the most radical ones. We know lung cancer, head and neck cancer, cervical cancer, all these cancers where you can cure if you're fast enough onto this. And we know already, though, the government data itself, we've had a shift in the patients who have been diagnosed earlier now, and some are now sadly coming in too late, and we can't do things for them. Frontline staff are saying they're seeing more advanced cancers than they've ever seen before. The government have got to recognise it is a problem. They can't keep telling us there's not a problem. We've been hearing, you know, everything's going back to normal. We've got, you know, 62-day targets there, and yet their government-owned figures have shown the enormity of the problem. They've got to face it. And we're here to help. You know, we've got lots of ideas.
It's interesting, Professor, because the Prime Minister speaks at a press conference today, 5 p.m. He'll be talking about COVID. Matt Hancock, the last time I heard him doing the Downing Street briefing, he talked about COVID. When did one of them last talk about the crisis in cancer care? I can't remember.
No, and I know it's a difficult subject, but they have to address it. And it can't be pushed in under the latest thing I heard, it was going to be in with the elective cancer backlog, as though backlog money does for everything, does the same for varicose veins as it does for cancer. And of course, every patient who's waiting is important, but there are some things that have to be that are time critical, and more money is needed. This isn't going to go away without more ring-fenced investment. And remember, we will then have a better service for the future. We went into COVID the bottom of the high-income countries in terms of survival. We weren't in a great place to start with. This could be the transformation we need, but it does need money. And I think the British public would be prepared to pay for that. Certainly all the cancer patients we speak to would be. Remember, one in two people are going to get cancer. It affects all our lives.
It certainly does. That's Professor Pat Price. She's chairwoman of the charity Action Radiotherapy and founder of Radiotherapy for Life and the Catch Up with Cancer campaign. Passionate words. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces and more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. A remarkable new poll shows that people no longer know what the Labour Party stands for. A third of Labour voters from the 2019 general election say it's not clear what the party of Keir Starmer stands for, compared to just one in seven Conservative voters who would say the same thing of their own party. Three in five UK adults now say, according to this poll by Savanta Comres, the Labour Party has lost its way. I'm joined now by Chris Hopkins, who is Associate Director of Savanta Comres. Chris, the trouble just keeps piling up for Keir Starmer. I saw a poll somewhere the other day suggesting his personal approval ratings are lower now than Jeremy Corbyn's were at a similar stage in the electoral cycle. But this goes to the heart of what went wrong for Labour in Hartlepool and other parts of the country in the election. People just think the Labour Party have become vacant and pointless.
Yeah, I think you put it very nicely. I mean, the metrics that we've put into this poll, such as, are the party of aspiration, whether they've lost their way. We asked for all of the parties, and the figures, the differences between those that say that the Labour Party has lost its way versus those that say that the Conservative Party have lost its way are just quite stark and revealing, and as you say, very indicative of the problems that Labour have had electorally over the last week.
And the thing is, the trouble then for Keir Starmer, Sir Keir Starmer, we know he's got to use an awfully modern expression, which I hate, reach out, but he's got to reach out to parts of the country which have turned their back on Labour. But he's not only got to do that now, he's got to also get back on side his own core supporters, whom Jeremy Corbyn, at least, could argue were with him.
Yeah, I think so. And I think a lot is made really of who Labour voters are, and I think often it's those that maybe shout the loudest that get heard. But ultimately there are still some very traditional Labour voters that voted Labour for a number of years that didn't lend their votes to the Conservative or didn't vote Conservative in 2019. But they aren't necessarily the metropolitan Liberal elite that gets bashed or that Labour gets bashed over the head with a lot. They are likely to be more traditional Labour voters, and they stayed stuck with the Labour Party in 2019. And the danger that Labour still has is that those might start to disappear too. Maybe 2019 and obviously the famous red wall voter, maybe that's just the start. And we are seeing a slight redrawing of the electoral map. Labour may not be as strong as it once was in its heartlands, but there were some positive signs in some of around the commuter belt of London and some places where they traditionally haven't done as well, or at least in the last sort of 10, 20 years. So it's not all isn't lost, but it is a difficult sort of tightrope to walk for Keir Starmer, whereby he has to try and get some of these votes back, but at the same time not alienate some of its core. Now I think where the Labour Party seems to be at the moment, at least what we see in this poll, is that no one actually knows what they stand for. And it's very difficult, I think, for anyone to make a bit of a choice other than those core voters that will never, ever, ever vote for a party that isn't the Labour Party. It's very difficult to win anyone else back or to convince anyone else to vote for you, because simply the public don't really know what they stand, or at least the Conservatives are considerably clearer about what they stand for, and they therefore give the electorate a choice, whereas the Labour Party don't really give them even that.
Having studied this poll, Chris, is a lot of the problem around the leadership? Is it around Keir Starmer? Is he seen as the problem by voters? I mean, after all, he is the leader. After all, he's the one who's got to articulate the vision.
I don't necessarily know that there's evidence in this poll to say that the leadership is the problem. But as you kind of alluded to, Andrew, the buck stops with the leadership, and it is up to the leadership to be the ones presenting this vision, to convince voters that actually, the current government isn't doing a very good job and we could do a better one. And I think that's the point. Yeah, I think I probably said to you before on this podcast that it's all well and good you saying that the Conservative Party aren't very good. And I think last year in particular, a lot of people didn't think that the Conservative Party were very good. But you then got to say, well, we'll do better. And that's where Labour struggle. And then, you know, the flip side in 2021 is that all of a sudden the Conservatives are doing better. So Labour have an even more difficult challenge on their hands because they've got to convince voters that the Tories are doing badly, which at the moment they're not. And then also got to convince voters that the Labour Party would be a better option. And that's you know, very difficult when the government is riding high in the polls.
And just finally, Chris, in all the conversations you had with the people you talked to in your poll, if you talked to a lot of Labour MPs, they dumped the blame for the poor showing in the elections last week on Jeremy Corbyn, the legacy of Jeremy Corbyn, the shadow of Jeremy Corbyn, the Marxism, all that stuff. Was there much evidence of that in the conversations you had?
I mean, I think if there was, then I think it's more about the fact that that the current leadership hasn't done enough to rid itself of
right.
that. I don't really think that it's legitimate in 2021 for the Labour Party to be blaming the previous leader. I think they've had plenty enough time to try and put some distance between them. And Keir Starmer did actually do a decent start with that, and we saw evidence of that in our polling. I think that ultimately what's happened towards the back end of 2020 and definitely in the start of 2021 is that not being Jeremy Corbyn isn't enough anymore. And yes, there might have been a lot of damage done by Corbyn, but I don't think it's sufficient now to keep blaming him ultimately. And it's, you know, it's similar in a way to, you know, some on the further left of the party who's still kind of blaming Tony Blair for losing the 2010
yes.
election, and ultimately you have to move on, and the buck stops really with the current leadership. You know, they need to be representing a vision of what Labour stands for. And I think arguably, if you'd have asked people, you know, 2-3 years ago, were they clear what Labour stood for, they would have probably been clearer under Corbyn than they are under Starmer. They might not have liked it, or would have been less likely to like it, but they were probably clear about what Labour stood for. Whereas now it just seems to be a bit of a mess and very, very vague.
Absolutely. That's Chris Hopkins. He's Associate Director of Savanta Comrades. Thanks for joining us. Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nicholls joins me now with the latest sports news. Huge event in the soccer calendar, football calendar, Tim. It's the FA Cup final. I know Chelsea are in it. Now, do I know who the other team is in it? Is it Leicester?
It is Leicester.
Hey, there. But Leicester. What about that?
There you go. Well,
I'm getting better at this,
club.
Aren't I? Yeah.
Well,
I want Leicester to win.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the view of their manager, Brendan Rodgers. He said today that they're the people's club. I think partly because, obviously, with this Super League nonsense, that the sort of so-called Big Six have come in for a bit of criticism. So whether Leicester or not are the people's club, I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, obviously that Premier League title win in 2016 was an amazing achievement and, you know, really unexpected given they were 5,000-1 at the beginning of the season. 5 years on, they've really invested well and they have a great structure at the club, and when they have to sell their big players, they reinvest that money really well. And they're in a cup final now and they're still in the top four. So that at the moment they're heading for the Champions League next season. But to win the FA Cup for the first time in the club's history would be a huge, huge thing. They've lost four finals, haven't been in a final since 1969. So this is a real great opportunity for them. But they're up against that relentless trophy-winning machine that is Chelsea, who are going for a ninth FA Cup. They've already won. They've won five during the Roman Abramovich era. And they're going to take some stopping.
Time that somebody else won. Isn't that the point? We just want somebody else to win, Tim, so we can get another name engraved on the trophy.
It would be very nice for Leicester to win it. It would be Brendan Rodgers' first trophy in English football. But look, Chelsea have had an incredible season, really. They were down in the dumps, in ninth place in the league, not looking very good. They sacked Frank Lampard. They brought in this German coach, Thomas Tuchel, and he's completely transformed their fortunes this season. They've had a couple of little blips, but the fact is they're in the top four at the moment, heading for a place in the Champions League next season. They're in the FA Cup final tomorrow evening, and then they got the Champions League final against Manchester City and Porto at the end of the month. So this, from what could have been a pretty disastrous season, could turn out to be one of the best in their history. And he has done a really, really good job, and Chelsea have been incredibly well organised. They've got huge strength in depth. They've got some big money players, but then they've got the players who they've brought through the academy. It's going to be a really tough test for Leicester. Now, while most of the country probably will want Leicester to win, you know, Chelsea are they're very experienced. They know what they're doing, and they're going to be a tough. They're going to be tough to beat.
They're going to win, don't you?
I think they are going to win. Yes. Let's see. It would be lovely if the underdog could do it. Even though Leicester are actually above Chelsea in the table at the moment, but look, Chelsea are the favourites. There's no getting away from that. But the really important thing, Andrew, before I go, is that there are going to be 21,000 fans at Wembley for that.
Fabulous.
And,
fabulous.
You know, the FA Cup is all about the fans. You know, whether the Champions League has become such a big thing, the Premier League has become such a big thing, that the FA Cup is often sort of, some people argue it's kind of lost its magic, it's lost its allure. But, you know, if you're a football fan, the FA Cup is still an incredibly special trophy to win. It's still one of the biggest days in the football calendar, as you mentioned at the start. And to get some fans back, there's only going to be about 6,000 from each club, but there's going to be lots of NHS workers, key workers, Brent residents. It's going to feel, you know, we had a few back for the League Cup final last month. This is sort of the next step as we, you know, we hope we edge towards normality. And to have 21,000 at Wembley tomorrow evening's fantastic, and you know, should make for a bit of an atmosphere, and you know, it'll give it more of a sort of big game feel, because of course last year's final, Arsenal beat Chelsea, empty stadium, just didn't feel quite right, especially in the FA Cup final.
I won't be watching, Tim, but I know you'll be cheering them on. Deputy Sports Editor Tim Nichols. Have we all forgotten how to dress after 40 months of being confined to barracks? Lockdown restrictions, rather a lot more of them, are going to end on Monday. Jan Moyer has written an, as ever, hilarious column in Today's Mail about how her friends are booked in for SROFL, that is, surgical removal of leggings, after the more than a year of lockdown. She joins me now. Jan, first question, what are you wearing?
What am I... Funny enough, Andrew, I am wearing leggings.
Are you?
It's only because it's my day off and I'm just about to go for a nice long walk around the park.
Right. And flip-flops?
No.
Right.
Really, no. I draw the line there. Flip-flops are for summertime. And but, you know, they are, for a lot of women in lockdown, they've been very comfy around the house wear, even like around the house to the shops and back again wear. But, you know, we're all going to have to up our game a little bit more as we kind of, you know, grind back into normal life.
And you make the point, the big thing for women is going to be shoes, because they've just got out of the habit of wearing heels. And as you make the point, those hideous Crocs have even been on red carpets.
That's right. They were, I mean, Crocs, the sale of Crocs during lockdown around the world has absolutely gone through the roof. I mean, they're literally up 64%, which is a terrifying thought. But that's the thing. I mean, once women were freed from the tyranny of wearing high heels, I mean, lots of us love wearing them. You know, despite the sort of slight pain or great pain. But once freed from the tyranny of wearing them, are we ever going to go back again? I mean, I really wonder. I think for a lot of women, that's it. I mean, I might go for a bit of a chunky heel. I tried out, I don't know if you noticed, Andrew, I tried out a bit of a chunky heel in the office this week, and it was okay. But it's going to be a very difficult journey for a great number of us.
But if we say the Jimmy Choos and the Louboutins are just going to rot in the cupboard, you think?
Well, I mean, who's going to climb back into 6-inch spike heels again? You know, apart from someone who's walking from a limo to a red carpet to a party and then home again. You know, I don't know.
Well, maybe Angela Rayner, the Deputy Labour leader, well, for now, the Deputy Labour leader, who got into all sorts of trouble for the inappropriate dress that the men in her party thought she wore when she went to that gorgeous metropolitan beauty spot, Hartlepool, called during the by-election.
That's right. But, you know, I'm with Angela on this one. It was a rainy, cold, blustery day on the northeast coast. You know, Angela was wearing a pair of really thick-soled, clumpy boots, which are actually incredibly fashionable in Paris at the moment, I might say. And she was wearing leggings. I'm not so sure about those leopard print leggings, but she was wearing clumpy boots and a parka and a hoodie. And certain of the male members of the Labour Party thought there was a bit too much. But, I mean, what should she have been wearing? That's what I want to know. So one of those red synthetic suits from Hobbs or somewhere that all the Blair babes wore back in the 90s. I mean, you've got to be practical about these things. She was stomping around the street. She was knocking on doors on a cold day. I think she was perfectly nicely dressed. I mean, maybe a little bit casual, but perfectly dressed for the weather. I mean, the men in the Labour Party were wandering around in ghastly anoraks and sort of Cornish
shiny suits.
Shoes. No one said a word about them.
No, I know. Now, Jan, big test for you on Monday, because
yes. You
can go into a restaurant, hurrah, yes. For the first time months and months. So you
indeed.
Won't be able to sit outside with your dressing gown underneath your parka and your wellies.
Right.
What are you going to wear?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, I am going to a restaurant on Monday. I booked into my favourite restaurant at lunchtime. And obviously, of course, I've got to go to the office first, go to the restaurant, and then come back to the office, which is sort of blowing my mind. how do I do that? I mean, I looked at myself in the office last week, and I thought, oh, my God, I'm dressed to go to a cocktail party. Because I've forgotten how to do this, I just can't get the pitch right anymore. So it's going to be difficult, but I'm willing to give it a go. I'm looking at leopard print. I'm looking at velvet. I just can't make a decision, Andrew. I might have to call you on Monday morning
well,
to give me some advice.
We can have a consultation. Perhaps you could take a leaf out of the Duchess of Sussex, because she was on parade, wasn't she, looking elegant the other day?
Well, I mean, you know, we're all absolutely gobsmacked at her sort of lockdown wardrobe. I mean, when she makes these sort of little podcasty television appearances, she's wearing dresses from designers like Caroline Herrera and Oscar de la Renta, which are the absolute sort of designer peak of American designers. I mean, it's what Park Avenue matrons wear. It's what incredibly wealthy people wear. Most of those dresses. She wore a beautiful lemon print one that was about £3,000. So it's kind of all right for Meghan, looking very sweet there on the sofa, but I'm afraid it's beyond most of us.
Yes, yes. And of course, as you make the point, Prince Harry looks a bit like a gardener, loafing around in those awful socks. But that's when he has socks on. Don't forget that one thing.
Well,
there'll be no shoes or socks.
Yeah.
Lockdown.
I mean, one of the many interesting things about his appearance on Oprah or with Oprah was what he was wearing. I mean, obviously, he's gone to pieces now that he doesn't have a valet laying out his his clothes in the morning. I mean, he was wearing a horrible old scuffed pair of shoes and really nasty socks, next to the fragrant Meghan, who looked absolutely impeccable.
As you will on, Jan, on Monday lunchtime when you go to the restaurant, even if I do have to have a hand in it.
Thank you.
That's the fabulous Jan Moyer. Do read her column in today's Daily Mail and every Friday, of course. Thanks for joining us. So we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, you can download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.